So here's what's going to happen today. So normally this is like a 2-hour masterclass thing. So what I have created for you is a deck that has about 160 slides or so. That is something to, so make sure that you get that and download it, because there's a lot of stuff to basically support thinking and examples and case studies and stuff for later. So there's definitely some things we'll talk a bit about in depth here today, but also I'm kind of introducing you to a resource that has many lines of inquiry that sprout out from it to help moving forward. So in the beginning, we'll give some foundational stuff. Some of the case studies I've moved forward a little bit to give you an example of the power of fusing content and social value and that type of thing. And then the thing, at some point I will run out of time, and when that happens, we'll be probably in around where the case studies really, it just goes case study after case study after case study. The way I have that set up is the case studies are organized by the different United Nations Sustainability Development Goals, so I've tried to cluster them roughly according to how they align to those goals. So that's really kind of where it leaves off, is just going to be a lot more case studies and so on. So that's a little bit of the flow and how things are structured. So we're all probably pretty familiar with the rhetoric nowadays about the publishing imperative, that due to the advent of the internet, content is now king, and it's location, location, location. All customer relationship touch points with you are mediated by content, whether it's what a salesperson is saying, how you're driving discourse in communities and social media, and all these things. Content is critical. And so companies who are not publishers, not media companies, not tribe developers by nature, need to learn these methodologies in order to compete in a space where content is so critical, from either just a "you need to answer my questions" to from a value-added perspective. So this dogma is reigning pretty strong, out there in the world of the post-internet era. But how are we doing at it? How good are we at playing the media game, at the publishing game as companies? And this is usually where there's a big sequence of fear-based statistics about how terribly things are going. I only have one or two slides of the sequence, but one is just, year after year in a lot of different studies where people are asked about how are their content programs doing, a lot of people don't feel confident about it. They say they're either kind of okay or they're not doing very well in vast proportion. And nonetheless, we see that the commitment to content doesn't go away. Year after year, people are saying we're either going to hold steady in our budgets or we're going to increase our budgets. So notwithstanding the fact that banner ads have a 0.05 click-through rate and 75% of marketing materials go to waste, and as much as 50% of mobile clicks might be accidental, and we're losing 1.7 billion or something like that per year due to bot traffic, notwithstanding all that stuff, people want to make more content. So people are getting that it's critical that we get this right. But why are we stuck? Why is so much of this content going unused? Why are these programs not showing business value or tangible value? And a lot of it is, there are many reasons, but one of the key ones is because of how self-absorbed we get as brands. We want to talk about ourselves. We want to essentially view people as consumers of what we sell, versus people who have needs and goals that we want to serve. And therefore, a lot of the content that we put out there tends to be very self-centered, very egocentric, and not often availing itself of all the streams of value that we could be delivering to people. And so one of the things that gets in a lot of people's way is not really understanding what it is that people care about. In other words, knowing what it is that keeps people up at night. And in many surveys related to how people are doing with their content and digital programs, a lot of times finding out what content should we be creating in the first place, what do people really care about, what is actually relevant, is one of the biggest obstacles that people have, in along with budgets and talent and all the other things that tend to float to the top of those the top of those surveys as far as causes for why the programs might not be doing so well. At 3M, so I work at 3M. It's a $32 billion company. It's essentially a conglomerate of 25 companies across 70 geographies. So it's very complex, and I deal with a lot of different businesses. It's almost like being a consultancy to many businesses, but within one. And so this goes way back to working with our dental division, where, you know, and this is pulled from research from the American Dental Association, what are the things that dentists, you know, that they really care about? What keeps them up at night? And one of the things that always sort of is a bit of a mind shift and focus is that a lot of what they care the most about have nothing to do with what we sell dentists. You know, they don't, it's not their composites, it's not the things that, you know, fill the teeth and the adhesives and all. They don't care about that stuff. They're commodities. The things they care about are really small business owner related matters. Okay, so while we do have products that have features and benefits, while we do need to do a good job communicating about those and the case studies and all of that type of stuff, if we want to look for more opportunities to add value in the relationship to the dentist, we probably need to get away from the black hole of self-centeredness. And so, you know, this whole Vogue and content marketing is a big response to this, right? It's about how are we, and conferences like this, you know, how do we equip people better to be media organizations, to be tribal developers, to be publishers, and to add value. And so that's, you know, of course, the Content Marketing Institute got built up all around that, and this is their definition of content marketing. Folks like Jay Baer early on came out with this whole, you know, utility thing that, you know, businesses have been focusing too much on how can we create more hype and make our products more exciting versus asking how can we help, how can we be more relevant, and all that kind of stuff. He was a big evangelist for this a number of years ago. And there's a lot of questions being asked now about these streams of value and how do we need to think differently about marketing in order to achieve this. And so as a part of, you know, this book, Killing Marketing, that the Content Institute folks just came out with, you know, they're focusing on this area of how we get so good at content that we can actually charge money for it. In other words, how is it that non-media companies really go all the way and become media companies? But ultimately, there's this whole concept of how to think differently. And if we look at, you know, some of the dogmas we have to get over, this was kind of one of the big lessons of Amex Open Forum. How many people have heard of this? Okay, not too many. Okay, so Amex Open Forum is basically, they were publishing about 20 blog articles a day at one point, all focused on small business owners and helping them be better small business owners. But it wasn't just the content, it was already also the community. And all these case studies, I'm always going to punch up the community dynamic since it's a social conference and network value and that type of thing. So what they do is they basically brought together a community of small business owners to help answer each other's questions, to provide support, essentially for being better small business owners. But American Express is not actually promoting any of their products on this resource. And this is, you know, 20 blog articles a day. That's expensive, right? It's a lot of effort. Cultivating community, as you know, is a lot of effort. Forums and how you handle responses and so on. Even though they are giving away this free content and they're not promoting a single American Express product, it is their number one source of lead gen for their small business credits division. And so this has been one of the big revelations for a lot of people who start to get their head around this. You mean I could just give something away and not talk about myself and yet have that realized business value? To be the number one lead source is really quite an accomplishment. But so here's a way of doing that. So this is my definition of content marketing, and I punch up a couple of things, you know, just to get people's mind in a certain space. That, first of all, content and application marketing. Applications are also important. It's not just content, but it's apps that we're delivering. That deliver content application products relevant to helping people achieve their goals. So we need to understand what those are. Or serve their experiential interests. If you're Lego and you want to make a Lego film, you're delivering a product that meets people's experiential needs because they want to go have a good time with their family. If you're publishing something for dentists for how to keep manage staff turnover in their clinics, it's much more practical, right? But the key is that this is a parallel marketing effort serving to increase brand relevance and support the sales and relationship goals of other products. So the key thing to think about here is that when you're creating content, when you're bringing conversations to social, when you're doing things, you need to bring intrinsic value in the content. In other words, the content isn't just communications talking about the value of something else. You're delivering content that has value to the point where people will stake their reputations on it by sharing it, or influence their boss by sharing it, or even pay for it or subscribe to it and so on. So, but the thing about content marketing is that the content that you're putting out there, the content products, must serve the business goals of the main product you're actually serving. So if you're not getting more leads, you know, in the funnel, if you're not, you know, increasing awareness of a particular thing you're trying to create a market for, then it's just a hobby and it either better be making money on its own, otherwise it's probably going to get cut at some point. But anyway, so key concept is parallel marketing effort. Content must have intrinsic value, must be a product. So this is one of the framework slides for a later study, but this is essentially an aggregation of what I've identified as all the value stream types you can create with content. So it can be everything from optimizing lead generation, optimizing how you segment and target your customers, winning search and social share of voice, creating and leveraging network value. There's a lot of different forms of business value. And just as sort of an interesting, I think, for a social crowd who, you know, lives and dies by network value and network dynamics, some really interesting things are happening in the content space. For example, Arrow Electronics recently realized that engineering self-education is the number one thing that they need. They need information on how to stay up to date on what is changing in the world of technologies. So we can either invest millions of dollars into developing all this content and doing social campaigns and building communities and doing all this other stuff and try to win against our foes in the social and search footprint space and do all this and take however many years and potentially not win that war. Or they can just go acquire it. So what they did is they bought 50 media properties, which includes buying first-party owned communities, which includes buying publishing and social management teams. And ultimately, they bought, think about the underlying network value, because this is 50 properties that accounted for the most traffic and eyeballs related to engineering education. They went and they bought the underlying network value. So imagine going and buying Facebook so that you can own the networks, right? So remember when Facebook crushed MySpace, when MySpace used to be here and now kind of went like this and then, right? So imagine, you know, just once that you get that network effect and it becomes hard to unseat those, at some point you start have to looking at, do we just acquire it, right? And I'm telling you, regulators have no concept of this right now and how to deal with this. It's a really freaky thing. Anyway, so there's all kinds of stuff here to contemplate around these forms of value, but a lot of them are business focused. What about social value? And what about how business and social value overlap? So what I believe is not only an opportunity, but is an inevitability, is that content marketing becomes content social entrepreneurialism as a business strategy. Because if you think about it, we're trying to figure out, how do we add more value? How do we be relevant? If our programs aren't doing all that they could be because in part because we don't know how to be relevant to people, that means we need to get good at the science of relevance. We must become masters of what's going to be meaningful and relevant to people. Unless we just want to hemorrhage out stuff nobody really cares about and they just kind of ignore, right? I mean, there are a lot of jobs and people, you know, putting braces on their kids' teeth doing that stuff, but it's got a shelf life. It's got a shelf life because it's not competitively viable. So it's good to set some intentions. So let's throw a little Dalai Lama on the situation. So, you know, there's this quote that I like here about whether science or religion is constructive or destructive depends on our motivation and whether we're guided by a real concern for the well-being of others and an appreciation of the oneness of humanity. And I think you can replace science or religion with marketing here and say the same thing. So here's where my aha moment came up with this stuff. Back in the early 2000s, I wasn't really interested in business and that kind of stuff. I was a lot more focused on education and having clients like History Channel and Smithsonian and doing super deep content and online exhibits related to the history of Jamestown or the origins of the Lakota and all kinds of stuff like that. Really focused on education because that's really where my passion was. Not so much about selling stuff, but more about educating people. Now, around that time, one of the projects I did won an award from this organization called the World Summit on the Information Society, which was basically focused on who are using information and communication technologies in order to serve what at that time was the Millennium Development Goals, ending, eradicating hunger and poverty and all this kind of stuff. And there are these 8 or 9 pillars of empowerment that the World Summit uses to judge their products by, the digital products, in order what is feeding into those. Now these have converted over to the Sustainability Development Goals. They went from Millennium Development to Sustainability Development. And for the last number of years, I've been now a judge with this organization, reviewing 100 plus products a year from all around the world in terms of people delivering social value solutions, social entrepreneurialism solutions. So this is this kind of dual mentality I have around social value as well as driving business value, because I help big companies like 3M get good at this stuff. But I also am a judge and work with people and partnerships and so on for people doing social good. And what I find is some of the best content marketing and network leveraging stuff that I see isn't coming from brands. It's coming from university groups, it's coming from nonprofits, it's coming from NGOs, it's coming from people who are coming up with really ass-kicking solutions to serious problems. And what we find is that I think there's this opportunity to overlap methodologies. And so my aha moment around this stuff was in 2005, after I was getting kind of well-known doing all this, you know, stuff for History Channel and whatnot, and starting my first corporate gigs, which pay better. And the first project I worked on was this Johnson & Johnson thing, where basically they spent about $350,000 in 2005 dollars providing a suite of lifestyle wellness management tools for people living with diabetes to basically reduce the effort of managing their conditions. And what blew my mind on this is that, wow, you know, they're not being very promotional on this site. They're giving away this resource that's actually going to like help people live longer and better in order to build and earn a relationship with them. And I thought, this is very powerful. They deserve the business of people because they're listening to them and they're saying, how can I help you live a better life, right? So I thought this was fantastic. I could do this. This is great. This is like what I was wanting to do on kind of a world-changing level, but now in the context of leveraging corporate resources and serving their business goals. So there's this question around, can we actually save lives with content and marketing? Like, can we save people from death? You know, that, I mean, that's a pretty big thing, right? When I said, how can we, you know, use marketing to change the world, right, that's what I'm saying. I mean, if you can save a life, that's a pretty big deal. So let's, what about infant and maternal mortality rates? So this is one of the case studies that I'm front-loading into this to give you a sense of just the magnitude of what's possible here. And then again, there's a lot more of these case studies on the end for when I run out of time. But so one of the Millennium Development Goals back before the Sustainability Development Goals is they had these really high infant and maternal mortality rates in India, like ridiculously high, 43 lives per 1,000 births and 31 per 1,000 live births. I mean, just huge mortality rates. And for both maternal and infant, they wanted to reduce these. So they created a text message-based information delivery service. So think about SMS, not Social Media Summit, but SMS text messaging. And what they did was, is by giving information timed with the woman's last period, so in sync with the development of the child and up to the first 2 years of age, they get several messages per week to help them identify any early warning signs or take preventative prophylactic steps in order to ensure that they're going to be healthy. Within a year and a half, they got 600,000 subscribers into this just in Bangladesh alone. 600,000 in a year and a half. And by the way, it's revenue positive. They actually charge a few rupees for it, but it's free to the super poor. So there's actually no barrier of entry. As judges for these things, so this is one of the things from the World Summit Awards, when we're looking at this stuff, we actually look for if they can come up with revenue models, because then they're more self-sustainable versus relying on donations. But it's still free to the super poor, so there is no barrier to entry. It's basically free. But what we found, and you think, well, if it's free, but you know, then why would anybody pay for it? If it's the same product and it's free, you'd think, you know, people are just going to take advantage of it. In fact, 80% of the people, of those 600,000 people, paid their few rupees or whatever it was to it because it's such a great service. So that's a very, very insightful case study right there. Now, what I found when, you know, so I'm in Abu Dhabi at this awards event and whatever, meeting these people, and I'm like, this is the coolest thing in the world. And then a year later in Sao Paulo, I meet this wonderful young man doing the exact same thing in Africa, okay? Creating essentially the same product. I'm like, well, have you heard of these folks in India? It's like, no, I haven't heard of them. Oh, well, okay. We should meet each other. Well, so this is emblematic of what happens. People come up with these fantastic solutions that can make a big difference in the world, but they don't have the ability to scale them. They can't scale them. Not only that, but they can only realize so much value out of them. The few rupees that they're making on that thing for India is not all the money in the world for generating more programs or whatever, right? Plus, they may be done by organizations that might shift priority sometimes and focus somewhere else entirely. But if you are a company who wants to, let's say, create a market for respirators and wants to focus on respiratory health and raise awareness for it, if you've got an information health delivery service platform that can get 600,000 young women tied into an opt-in to get routine messages from you influencing them on healthcare, you can probably complete my thought on that basis, right? Now you can start communicating about these things and influence the most influential people in the world in this particular context, which is young mothers, create this market even ahead of your ability to get there. So, and you start to think, you know what? if a 3M, if a Johnson & Johnson, if a whoever took this methodology and applied it in Latin America, in Africa, in wherever, and then, oh, yeah, you know what, actually, I guess it's a big deal in the United States, too. There are poor people here, too. Wow, maybe we should actually do some of this stuff here, too, right? This is kind of that reverse innovation thing that starts to happen when people actually kick ass in developing countries, you know, in order to realize what it actually takes to solve problems even in the industrialized countries, right? So you might start to think, if one of these companies started scaling this, you could maybe get a billion people into a marketing database in a, you know, in a few years. I mean, has anybody ever done that? Has anybody ever gotten 600,000 people into a marketing database in a year and a half? I mean, who isn't like promoting Justin Timberlake or somebody, right? Right, okay, so, you know, this is really big stuff. So if we look at like what Procter & Gamble was doing with young menstruating girls in Africa, by the way, in some countries, young women not knowing what a period is until they have one is as high as 50% across the entire populace in some countries, right? So this is a big deal, and there's case studies on this probably way later that we won't get to, but coming from UNICEF, but this is a big deal. And so when you're a young girl, a lot of girls fall out of schools because it's taboo, they don't know what they're doing, they're freaking out, there are no bathrooms, okay? So Procter & Gamble, you know, knowing that it's all about relationships in Africa, starts building bathrooms and doing different things and giving away tampons and pads and that type of thing as a means of developing a relationship with the people. That's beautiful and a very fantastic thing to do. At the same time, it's not as scalable as if you start leveraging text messages, which they have all over Africa, right? So here, imagine, so hypothetically, let's say your existing distribution are these little orange areas right here, and you've got this blast radius of near-term distribution development happening with whatever your product is. Well, based on scaling an SMS information delivery service, suddenly you could take up a pretty good part of the continent of Africa because everybody's got SMS, right? Even ahead of your ability to get there. And sometimes you need to start creating these markets years ahead of time. And if the cost to scale is low, which in this case it absolutely is for something like this, you're building really deeply opted in relationships where you're saving lives and improving people's lives and developing those relationships as you're expanding into these areas. So this is really the power of some of this stuff, is to think about the scale and of impact that you can have at low cost. And so I hope this is making sense. Now, still on the on the saving lives end of the spectrum, another example is something that I worked on with the University of Michigan back in around 2010. And this was a case study where we proved using science that if you use content highly tailored to the psychographics and motivations of the individual, that you can potentially cure addiction to tobacco. So the way this works is you basically identify all these different, you screen people and identify all these things about what motivates them and various influencers in their lives, and you tailor the content. And the content that we delivered was tailored down to the sentence fragment level. And so this is something you can study later. But basically, you know, we had these different control groups, these different groups, 1, 2, and 3, and we had untailored messages, and then we had messages that were hyper-tailored to people's psychographics, again, down to the sentence fragment level. So if it's like, oh, we see that, you know, you failed to meet your smoking goal by 10 cigarettes last week, and you do have a partner who is not supportive of your lifestyle, blah, 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 right? So there's all this stuff, and all the advice and everything maps to those things. But what I wanted to call out from a social perspective, if we look at the determinants of behavior, these are the determinants of behavior that you influence in order to influence behavior, and two of them are social related. So one is societal norms, and the other is social support. So here, this is what I kind of want to elevate it from a social perspective. When we are accountable to other people, we are far more likely to be motivated to actually make the changes that we want to make. So if you start thinking about the social communities you're developing, you ask yourself, how can I create more tribal accountability within that tribe in order to generate a particular kind of behavior? Or if we want to change the world and get people out of data and cultural silos, we might say, how do we start to generate cross-tribal accountabilities, right? But those are two core determinants, behavior are social related. And so when people come in and they set their goals, all this content is super tailored, there's several screens they go through, and I was already describing this. And then, you know, the various advice and things are all tailored. So literally there could be millions of different message permutations. Okay. And then we have the reaching out, you know, to always, when people set their goals, to reach out to their communities and try to gain support. So, but then there's this whole notion of, can we be trusted? So, you know, no slot deck is complete without a quote from Seth Godin, but here he's basically talking about marketers are generally scummy people who try to make people buy stuff they don't need, and therefore we've lost a lot of trust. 80% of CEOs don't trust marketers. Somebody in the audience once said to me, yeah, but how many of the general public trust CEOs? And I said, fair enough. But generally, there's a lot of distrust for businesses in general. 54% of people don't trust brands, 71% of companies, but they think that 71% of companies should be actively involved in solving social problems. So there's this interesting kind of conflict here in that people don't trust, but they want stuff. They believe they should be responsible for things. Only 30% of people feel brands communicate honestly about their commitments and promises. So we have this dynamic of high expectations and low trust. And in this study from Toluna, 1,000 people were surveyed on this, 72% often or sometimes actively seek out companies who donate to social causes. And they also ask them, well, what are the things that matter? And the skin in the game of dollars and revenue or taking a strong social position on a topic were some of the things that they said, you know, were high on their list of the ways they like to see brands be involved. But what does bullshit smell like? So everybody has probably seen this, right? Bullshit smells like, you know, fist pumping a black dude, you know, during Black Lives Matter with your product in a thing that looks like people are having a party when in fact they're freaking out about potentially being murdered by police, okay? That's tone deafness par excellence, okay? This is not how you want to get involved in social issues. You also, you know, don't want to build monuments to the power of women when you're currently being sued for gender discrimination for, you know, in your HR, right? So there's a lot of stuff you really don't want to do in this world. And you also don't want to potentially hijack serious issues to make a profit, which some people have been doing, which has given a bad rap to the very important issue of breast cancer, right? So these are some things you kind of don't want to do in this space. But it doesn't smell like, and this is what often people focus on, are these kind of campaign things that have social meaning. So a lot of people are familiar with Dove Real Beauty, where they deal with issues of, I see heads nodding, a lot of issues about people's, you know, body and beauty perceptions about themselves. Dove's been doing a lot of great stuff activating social discourse and contemplation around this. There's the Always Like a Girl campaign, which is about, you know, around when girls start to get a low self-esteem at one point because they're told they're weaker and inferior and they start to internalize that. And so there was all this thing about how being like a girl is actually very powerful. And then some of the stuff with the skin in the game maybe gets a little more extreme, where, for example, Unilever in India is focused on transgender adoption. Going into that, that's a big deal there. So that's a pretty hot topic, you know. And then it gets more embedded in the business, where you have this one-to-one thing, like Tom's has. You buy a pair of shoes, somebody underprivileged gets a pair of shoes. And probably one of the best examples I've seen of integrating it into the business model is Connie Duckworth, who realized that women in Afghanistan who are making all these fantastic carpets are, like, you know, 90% illiterate and don't have power. So she's like, I need to economically empower these people for them to gain in order to, you know, gain societal empowerment. So she created a platform to connect the weavers there with buyers in other markets like the US and Europe. And this, like, suddenly made families far wealthier. So this gave the women power, but the families were only allowed to participate in this program if the women had more self-determination. The whole family had to be allowed to go to school. They had to be allowed to go to doctors. There were all these requirements they had to meet to empower the women in order to be a part of this program. And now they went from, you know, 90% of Afghan women being illiterate, if that's the number, 100% of their weavers are literate. So really cool stuff. Anyway, so here's this trajectory of BS into, you know, bringing it into your business model. So social value is a thing. There's, you know, there are a lot of different areas of discourse and study to focus on to develop skills in this area, like social innovation and entrepreneurship and so on. Stanford Social Innovation has a magazine and a website and all this, and it's a very inspiring place to learn about how to bring social entrepreneurship into what you're doing. You know, social entrepreneurialism is often identified as the attempt to draw upon business techniques to solve social problems. And what I believe with what I'm talking about here about using marketing and business is sort of the inverse, where you can, you know, businesses can draw on social value techniques to solve business problems, as I've been commenting on. Another, Michael Porter commented on this, and this whole notion about shared value, that this can actually transform how capitalism works if we try to identify more ways to add value. And so if we look at this here, this is one of my favorite thinkers in this area for stakeholder theory, R. Edward Freeman, where you know, we need to understand the complex interconnections between economic and social forces. I'm going to violate and read the slide at you. Isolating social issues as separate from economic impact, which they have, and conversely, you know, isolating economic issues as if they had no social effects, misses the mark both managerially and intellectually. In other words, failing to understand this connection creates a huge disconnect in how reality works, and will fail to describe and predict the business world as it really is. So the whole notion of stakeholder theory is, how do you look at the ecosystem of players that you're affecting and partnering with, and figure out how to drive and add value in relationship to them? So what skills do we need? I'm going to do this real quick and then the Q&A thing. So here's one of the critical things is, what do we need to get good at in order to do this? And what does the new job security look like? So of course we have the relationship management side. This is a lot of what you guys are doing today with, you know, social media and stuff, trying to drive relationships and build brand and all that type of thing. So marketing, sales, service, all that kind of stuff. The basic business stuff is core. But also publishing and media, this whole content marketing and the advent of the internet and media, right? We need to get good at creating relevant content that people are actually going to want and understand how to distribute it. But we also need to understand application development, because there's an application layer to these things, and if we can develop in the application layer to deliver this value, we're going to have more power. But also startup methodologies. This isn't about being a marcom or being a social media person or being this. This is about being an innovator, okay? This is about innovation and driving value. So as you start to look at, okay, what is it that we can create and invent to deliver value, having, you know, startup methodologies as part of what you do is key. And then there's this civil society services thing that I've been talking about this whole time, around what are the different kind of solutions people bring. Now we're at the end here, where it's Q&A time, and this is right about where I thought we would drop off, where as we move forward, we start to get into innovation frameworks. So in this deck for you to contemplate later are all these different frameworks for innovation that you can start to think about to inform how you add value. And anyway, so there's just a ton of stuff in here around innovation frameworks and different, you know, all that kind of stuff, new questions to add to your creative briefs. And then the deck gets into the sustainability development goals. And here's what I was talking about at the beginning, where we have, for example, poverty, and then we have example case studies that go through here, zero hunger, multiple hunger case studies, and then it just kind of trails on from there. So anyway, so that's the bulk of the talk and the key concepts and a sense of what's in this resource for you to use later to start to build out some of these skills and this mode of thinking. And I can take questions at this point if there are any, or blather on about some other slides depending on how you'd like to play it. I'd imagine you could build some pretty amazing network maps out of that kind of thing. And on that note, that is something that when we get into these case studies down here, I really tried to highlight a lot of network mapping examples. Again, you know, because given your social focus. So this guy, Samuel Sinyangwe, so he had this data and technology to prevent violence. And as it turned out, no government database existed to actually show how much police violence there was. And so they crowdsourced all of this data on murders or potential deaths or unfortunate situations with people dying in interactions with the police. They had to crowdsource this from two kind of databases in order to start to build this map. And now they have this map so you can actually see clustering where this stuff happens. And they've used this data to show some really interesting things to debunk false narratives, because people say, well, where there's more poverty and all that kind of stuff, there's going to be more crime. Where their demographics are where they're at, there's going to be more. But they show, no, Orlando, Florida and Buffalo, New York are almost identical in terms of many of their dynamics, but one of them has a lot of police killing people and the other doesn't. And they start to find that it's actually mapped to policy, that when the way that police manage policies in their organizations has an immediate, very strong correlation to the amount of deaths there are and the amount of injuries. So there's a whole bunch of data in here and different things around all that. But there's a number of examples back in this deck that relate to these cases where by creating these points of data that move in geography, in these cases, these bottles and where they are, there's tremendous stuff that you can end up mapping in those sorts of things that has interesting social implications. Another quick example is that there's one in here where people are tracking things like health issues related in different states and what people are tweeting. So for example, from the semantic data from tweeting, you can identify with very strong correlation places where obesity is an issue. So for example, people talk, if they talk about watching TV a lot, what stuff that they're eating, they have this calorie counter correlation related to social data and all that to map the stuff. Lots of really interesting ways to mine into networks and data and insights you can get from it, and then ways you can respond to that from a social strategy perspective. I would say that they actually are serving a cause with Amex Open Forum, because one of, and you'll see this in one of the sustainability development goals, is economic empowerment. So just like that Arzu Ruggs, the woman helping the women in Afghanistan, by helping people be more prosperous and run their businesses better, that's economic empowerment. You're actually helping them feed their families, and that addresses poverty directly. So when Amex Open Forum goes out and says, what can we do to help you as a small business owner be a more successful small business owner, a more respectful business owner, because they do leadership stuff and all that type of thing, they actually are doing a cause there just by helping people be better small business owners. So it's not all about saving lives and in the sense of like ending malaria or slavery or that type of thing. Those are key things. But if one of the underlying questions is, if you don't really have a purpose, how do you find a purpose? And I would say that tangents, like if we think about, you know, Dove and Always and that type of stuff, I mean, they make soap and various things, right? Like what are they gonna do? You know, it's a lot harder if you sell Cheetos, right? You're gonna have to really say, okay, what are we gonna take a stand on, and we're gonna commit to this, that's gonna be who we are. And it's harder to connect it, right? But if you're doing like what Dove did, they took a social issue and decided we're gonna go all in on this issue. But then what this requires is for people to really come together in the organization and decide what that's gonna be. And here's where breaking down the barriers between corporate philanthropy and corporate social responsibility programs and the P&Ls comes in. Very often in companies, these areas of the business are balkanized from one another, sometimes by design. And so what I think is beautiful about applying these methodologies is actually breaking down those barriers between these areas of the organization, so that as you're using business to solve social problems and social value methodologies to solve business problems, you're also breaking down those organizational silos and better aligning the organization to now start to drive that purpose. But the people in the social, corporate social responsibility, sustainability, they're gonna be more of the kind of psychographic and the heart to really say, okay, we are gonna make an argument that we're gonna take a stand on, I mean, why is Vicks taking transgender, you know, parenting in India as a thing, right? I mean, somebody had to have some real passion around that in that company to drive that, and they're doing it, and they're doing amazing work around it. So I think there's some stuff there. Where are we at here in terms of time? 2 minutes, okay. Yes. Right, so I think, and you came in a little later, right? No, that's fine, and that's fine. And in this deck has a lot of frameworks and things. It's like 160 slides, so please download the deck, and there's stuff to feed ideation later. In that slide, there's a big grid of about 30 little white boxes that are about business value streams, okay? Are you trying to generate leads, or do you wanna let, you know, there's like all these categories of business value. So, and I actually use that framework as a diagnostic with business. So like if I'm, you know, start dealing with, you know, our safety division or something, and I start to look at their strategies and I say, okay, what are the different values you can realize? What's low hanging fruit? What seems really crucial to your goals? You know, are you trying to appeal to more long tail customers who need more digital stuff? Are they more small business owners? What are their tiers? There's a lot of strategy, of course, going into, you know, how you're gonna prioritize these things. But so I think if you start with, okay, what's the strategy and what's the go to market and who you're trying to address, And then identifying what, I mean, if you don't understand, if you don't, haven't identified what keeps them awake at night, what the values are for them that you're going to meet and achieve, then it gets really hard to answer this question, not only for leveraging social value, but just for being relevant at all in your marketing. So this should just be best practice in what you do for marketing, period, from the beginning. So if, and this is really just about adding that social value layer of analysis to this, to say, okay, if there's our feature and benefits, and then there's how do they be more successful in applying our product, and out from there, if you're in safety, for example, and you want to make sure your employees are wearing their respirators or their hearing protection, that's not about selling more product. It's about helping them ensure compliance or stay up with regulations, and on out to how do I, you know, get a raise as a safety manager, right? You know, kind of getting a, as you start to explore that spectrum from the blast radius of product out to adjacencies and moving outward and figure that out, you'll get to the you'll start to have some of the information on the table to begin to answer that question. Because then it might not be a matter of, oh, we need to come up with more money we didn't have to justify something else. It's about how we maybe even redirect what we're currently spending. In other words, getting more bang for our buck. And so I always go for that and try to educate around that with folks when we're doing this kind of work, because then it's not about paying more, it's about getting more from what we're currently paying. So I think you're standing up. Does that mean we're at the end here? Okay. Okay, well, thanks so much for your time. And, you know, Carlos Abler is my name. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to continue dialoguing about this stuff and consulting with you on these things. Very passionate about it. I'm in your corner. The deck is there. There's a lot of stuff in it. Feel free to reach out with questions anytime, and enjoy the rest of your conference.
Thank you.